Thanks for tuning in to the Next Level Church podcast. For more information, check out our website at nextlevelchurch.net.
Good morning. My name is Rob, and I'm so excited for you guys to be here today. If I haven't had a chance to meet you, I would love to meet you after the service. I'll be hanging out in the lobby, and want to invite all of you to participate and to get something a little bit more out of what you're about to experience. We do that through an app called YouVersion, and it's a free app, and there's an event page on there, and the steps to get there are up on the screen. And this is an app that allows you to see all the scriptures I'm going to cover. It gives you a place to take notes. There's a free fun poll in there, some other fun things as well. So go ahead and open up YouVersion, take out your smartphones and your tablets. Today we're continuing our series entitled, What is Love? Baby, Don't Hurt Me. And what we're doing is we're breaking down the definition of love. We all use the word love. We say we love things. We love pizza. We love ice cream. We love people. We love sports teams. But when we use the word love, what is it that we are supposed to mean? And for the last handful of weeks, we've been breaking down the definition of love, which we find in 1 Corinthians 13. Corinthians is written by a guy by the name of Paul, and he started a church in an area called Corinth, and you can actually visit ancient Corinth now if you want to take a look at where he was. And he wrote this letter to a dysfunctional church. And this dysfunctional church, he wrote it to them to encourage them to get away from some of their dysfunction, and he tried to point them to something better, and what he was trying to point them to was love. So for the last few weeks, we've been breaking down the definition, and on week one, we learned that love is patient. Patience is not simply the ability to wait. It's how we behave while we're waiting. On week two, we saw that love is kind. Kindness isn't overlooking mistakes, but loving people through them. On week three, we saw the first thing that love is not, that love does not envy, and envy is missing out on what you do have because you're focused on what you don't have. In the following week, we talked about how love doesn't boast and it is not proud, and being boastful is claiming your own will and power are supreme over the person you are supposed to love. And pride is believing you are the most important person in the room. We followed up with seeing that love does not dishonor others. We define dishonor as it is the person who does not care enough for those it is around to act becomingly or politely. And that is, you can tell when you dishonor someone, it's when you no longer care about being polite, you no longer care about their feelings or who they are, that you're just going to say what you think and you're going to tear them down and there's no honor in the relationship. That is a dishonor. And Paul says that love does not dishonor. There is no dishonor in love. We follow that up with self-seeking. Love is not self-seeking. And self-seeking is when you love someone based off of feeling, and when that feeling changes, you get out of the relationship. And we've all experienced that kind of love based off of a feeling where we had these emotions, we had these things going on inside of us, we really liked being around someone, but then when the relationship got tough, either they left or we left, and the feelings disappeared. But love is not a feeling, love is a choice that you make, that you choose who you're going to love. We followed that up by talking about how love is not anger, and anger is an emotion. But what we do with that anger is a choice. However, there are consequences when we choose poorly. And we've all experienced anger. We've all gotten angry over something. Some of us have punched holes in the walls. Some of us have given people the one-finger salute in traffic. We've experienced the emotion of anger. And last week, what we talked about is anger is a choice, that when you get angry, what you do with that anger is up to you. But there are consequences when you choose poorly. If you're not careful, though, anger leads to bitterness, and we talked about this last week, and bitterness is like drinking poison and hoping it hurts the other person. And we've gotten all these definitions from 1 Corinthians 13, and each and every week we're reading the definition of love found in 1 Corinthians 13, and I'd like for us all to participate and to read this definition once again. It's going to come up on the screens. 1 Corinthians 13, 4 through 7, on the count of three, would you humor me and just read it out loud with all your might, like the whole world is counting on you to read this. One, two, three. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Now that we've read the text, I'd love for us to spend just a few seconds and ask God to speak to our hearts in a personal way. Every week, or almost every week, I invite you to pray a simple prayer. There's no magic in this prayer. It's just something I do to focus myself and to hear from God. And the prayer that I pray is, God, would you speak to my heart And would you give me the courage to do whatever you tell me to do? And I'd like to invite you to spend a few seconds asking God to speak to you. Would you pray? God, we're in such desperate need of your love. And we just ask, God, that you would just pour it out over us today, that you would change our hearts, that you help us to fall more in love with you as we embrace and experience your love for us. And we ask, God, that you'd speak to our hearts in a personal way, that you'd speak louder than the other voices in our life, and that you'd speak through the hardness of our hearts. And we ask you to give us the courage to do whatever you tell us to do. And God, I just ask that the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart will be acceptable in your sight. Lord, you are my rock and my redeemer. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, the next part of the definition says, love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. Now, if we don't do a little bit of research, we could easily say that this part of the definition doesn't apply to us. The rest of the definition of love, we can all relate to. We can see how we fit into these things. But this idea of not delighting in evil, that word evil is something that we reserve for someone else. Like, when we think of the word evil, we don't think of, like, I'm evil. You don't think that you're evil. Like, I hope that we're not evil, especially when you're rejoicing with evil. Like, that's like a cartoon bad guy level. That is like this. This is what it looks like to rejoice in evil, okay? That is on a whole nother level. Like, when I read the text, rejoice in evil, I just have this picture of, like, a James Bond villain. Like, just like, whoa, ha, 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 ha. This is his cat that he's petting. Whoa, ha, 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 ha. Rejoice in evil. I'm going to conquer the world. Like, none of us are there. At least I hope. If you are, please turn yourself into the police, okay? Like, none of us are, like, on that level of evil. And so it would be really easy to just say, well, I'm not like that. In fact, let's just talk about, in our mind, when we think of evil, what are just some of your favorite bad guys? What are some of the people that you just say, when you think of the word delighting in evil, when you think of that phrase, who are some people that just come to mind? They can be fictional characters. Please don't name anyone in this room. Fictional, maybe people from movies or TV or for books. When you think of delighting in evil, who do you think of? Just shout it out. Yeah. Ursula. I heard Ursula. That's the only one I heard out of that. Hans Gruber. Thank you very much. Hans Gruber, one of the greatest bad guys ever. I'm hearing something over here. Hannibal Lecter. That dude is evil. Woo! That creeps me out. That creeps me out. Who? The Joker. Okay, thank you for saying that again. I heard yogurt, and I was trying to process. I mean, I know some people don't like yogurt, but I don't know how it's evil. Okay, the Joker. Yes, he is crazy bad. All right, anyone else? Just one more. Crowley and Catwoman. Who is Crowley? From Supernatural. Okay, I missed that TV show. Crowley. I'm sure. Is Crowley a boy or a girl? He's the king of hell. Yes, okay. He is. He would be evil. Good old Crowley. All right. Now, when we say does not delight in evil, it is very easy for our brains to go there. We think of the Grinch. We think of Darth Vader. We think of Voldemort. We think of these evil people. And we say, okay, that's not me. But there's actually a better word to describe evil. And the real word that was written is the word iniquity. And it is a picture not necessarily of evil, like a James Bond villain, but it is more a picture of sin. Now, if you put sin into the context, does not delight in sin, all of a sudden it starts to apply to us. Now, something you may not know is that the New Testament part of the Bible was written in Greek, and when they talk about sin, there are actually 33 different Greek words that they use to describe sin. Two of the main ones, though, have this picture of one of them is missing the mark. And so when they say sin, sometimes they'll talk about how that is like missing the mark. And this is the idea of if you've ever shot a bow and arrow and you were shooting it at the target, and as you shot it, you just missed the mark, that the arrow went off track, that it wasn't intentional, you weren't trying to miss anything, you just were aiming, you were doing the best that you could, but you missed the mark. And so sometimes when the Bible talks about sin, it's just painting this picture of like you're doing your best, you're doing the best that you can, but you missed the mark. It's kind of like this. Like, if maybe you were inspired to clean up your language a little bit, and you said, "Okay, I don't want to cuss anymore," and so I'm going to do everything I can. I'm going to get some accountability to help me not use swear words, and I'm going to start practicing substitute swear words because that's what good Christians do. We don't say the swears, but we say things like shut the front door, or we say what the hellman's mayonnaise, and we replace phrases with cuss words so we feel better about ourselves. And so you're working on it, and you're saying, okay, I've got this down, and you're going for a good week, and you're feeling really good about yourself, and things are going great, but then one night, on your way to bed, you stub your pinky toe on the coffee table. Yes. And at that point, it just comes out of your mouth, fudge, except you don't say fudge. Like, it just, it's like, ah, and at that point, you say, oh, I was doing so good. Like, I've been working so hard. I didn't intentionally do this. I stubbed my toe, and like, come on, that's got to be justified, right? It hurts so bad, and you miss the mark. You didn't intentionally do it, but sometimes that's how sin is, that you're doing your best. You're not aiming for sin. You're not trying to sin, but it just kind of happens, and you stumble upon it. And that's one idea of sin. The other idea, though, is the idea in this verse. And the other idea is this idea of iniquity. And it literally means to intentionally climb on the other side of the fence. Now, I don't know if you've ever climbed a fence before, but you don't accidentally climb a fence. Like, you're not just walking up to a fence and say, how did I get on the other side? Like, I didn't mean to do this. And so the idea of iniquity is that literally you are seeing something and you're saying, I know that on this side of the fence is God's standards. I know on that side of the fence is sin, and I'm intentionally going to climb this fence and hop over there. I'm going to hang out there. And when it says does not delight in iniquity, it is painting this picture of delighting in sin. And so there's actually two kind of meanings to this, that when Paul is writing does not delight in evil, he's painting two things. One is for our reaction to sin, that when you sin, whether you miss the mark or you climb up on the other side of the fence, that you shouldn't have this feeling of like, yes, I nailed it. I sinned really good today. Woo! Like, there should be a feeling inside of you saying, I don't like this. This doesn't settle well with me. But the definition doesn't just end there. There's more to it. This idea of not delighting in evil is, it paints this picture that has a lot more weight than even thinking about when you stub your toe or when you intentionally sin. To not delight in evil carries the idea of not gloating over someone else's guilt. To not delight in evil has the idea of not gloating over someone else's guilt. And really, what Paul, the picture he is painting here, is that when someone else sins and in your life and someone else messes up, whether they miss the mark unintentionally or they intentionally climb over that fence, that your response to them should be somewhat of sadness. That you don't rejoice and say, yeah, they're going to get what's coming to them. God's going to strike them down. Or, man, oh, yeah, they messed up. Look how bad they are. That you don't go around spreading the bad news of someone else. That you don't rejoice in the fact that someone else made a mistake. I have twin five-year-olds, and I tell a lot of stories about my kids, especially my son. And one day he'll probably have to go to counseling because of all the stories that I've told about him. But I tell more stories about my son because he just inspires more stories. He has a little bit more difficult time in life. He gets into trouble a little bit more than his twin sister. And his twin sister, I am convinced that if we only had one kid and we had just his twin sister, my daughter, my wife and I would become prideful as parents because she is so good most of the time. We would just think, man, we are awesome as parents. But God gave us our son to humble us a little bit. And like, I'm not exaggerating here. Like, from birth, they were very different, even though they're twins. Like, because they're twins, they go through things at the exact same time. And so when teething happened, my son let us know that he was teething. He would scream all night long, like he wouldn't sleep. It was awful. My daughter would sleep through the night, and she'd wake up with a new tooth. And, like, we wouldn't even know it. She didn't even cry. She didn't even express any frustration. Like, they just have very different personalities. And so most of the time when I'm telling stories, I'm telling stories about my son Hayden. My daughter has one thing, though, about her that it's just an interesting trait. Like, she gets to see her brother get into trouble a lot, and she rarely ever gets in trouble. And some of you have experienced this. If you come over to our house, you may have seen Hayden have a meltdown. And if you stop watching him and the circus show of his meltdown, and you turn your eyes to my daughter, you will see that as she watches him get in trouble, she has this little smile on her face that looks like this. Now, we've had to talk to her about this, that, like, we're so glad that you didn't get in trouble, But it is not right for you to smile when your brother is getting in trouble. Like, that's wrong. Like, that's rejoicing in evil. That's like saying, yeah, I'm off the hook, but I'm so glad he's getting punished. And that is something, that idea is something that it's not taught to us. It's actually part of our condition. It's part of our fallen nature that we as humans actually love to rejoice when other people get hurt. It is this idea of Schadenfreude. That's not a substitute cuss word, okay? That is a real word. It is a German word called Schadenfreude. Now, I don't know if you've ever experienced Germany, if you lived in Germany. I lived in Germany for 3 years, and it was in the 80s. And this is just a side note. This is completely random. But because I lived in Germany for 3 years, I can no longer give blood in America. My blood is contaminated because of mad cow disease. I don't think I have mad cow disease, but when I try to go give blood, they say, no, you can't give blood because you lived in Germany for 3 years. Now, one thing that is interesting is in 2001, they didn't have this rule, and so I gave blood. And my buddy Dan says that that's how the zombie apocalypse happens, because now my mad cow disease blood is out there in the public, okay? That is focus. That is a side note, okay? German word, though, Schadenfreude. Schadenfreude is a word that I want us to understand, because it is a great idea that is something that we don't have a comparable word to it in the English language. And so would you humor me and would you just say the word Schadenfreude after me? 1, 2, 3, Schadenfreude.
Schadenfreude.
This is what Schadenfreude is. It is the German word which describes our malicious enjoyment of the mishaps or misfortunes of others. Schadenfreude is this idea. It is the German word which describes our malicious enjoyment or the mishaps or misfortunes of others. It literally means harm joy. It's like a frenemy. It's harm joy, that when you Schadenfreude, it is that you get enjoyment out of someone else suffering, out of someone else going through pain, out of someone else making a mistake. Now, in psychology, they talk a lot about social comparison theory. And in the social comparison theory, it says that we are wired to constantly compare ourselves to people who we view as above us or below us. And Schadenfreude plays into this exactly, because there's something inside of us that we compare ourselves to people around us, especially when it comes to our morals. That by the way that we are wired, psychologists have said that when it comes to feeling like we're a good person, what we do is we like to hang out with people who are lesser than us. That somehow if we can find someone who is less than us, who's messed up worse than us, it allows us to feel better about ourselves without actually having to work on ourselves. It's this idea that if you're feeling a little bit insecure about your weight, but you don't want to go to the gym to lose weight, the key is just find some fatter people to hang out with, right? Because you hang out with them and instantly you're thin. Or if you feel like, I'm not a very moral person, I'm not a very religious person, and so I may have a lot of mistakes, but if you want to feel better about yourself, go find yourself a pagan. And then all of a sudden you're like, wow, I feel so much better about my choices. I'm not as bad as them. And according to social comparison theory, when it comes to our morals, we're constantly comparing ourselves to people who are below us. Now, researchers have found that people with low self-esteem are more likely to feel Schadenfreude than people who have high self-esteem. And so if you're a person who constantly compares, that is your wiring, that's how you are literally wired. All of us have this. But if you don't grow out of the phase of comparing yourself to others, it is a sign that you are suffering from low self-esteem, that you don't believe that you really are good enough. And in order to make yourself feel better, you actually celebrate when other people fall. And you enjoy being around or hearing stories or spreading gossip or hearing the gossip of others, because as long as some other people have some mess in their lives, somehow, in a sick, twisted way, it makes you feel better about your life. So let's just talk about this idea for just a second. Schadenfreude, it's this idea of rejoicing. It's harm joy. And if you think about the opinion of Christians and the general view of Christians out in the world, oftentimes when Christians make the most noise, it's when someone else makes a mistake. That when someone else falls, you'll hear all sorts of opinions, especially online, where Christians will come out and say, yeah, we told you they're gonna suffer. We told you that was gonna happen. Like, that's a bad person, that's an evil person, like, we don't like them, and they're gonna get the wrath of God, and people have this mindset of celebrating when others fall. But what is the Christian response? And the Christian response is not to celebrate or to gloat, because Paul says that love does not rejoice in evil. Love does not say, oh yeah, I'm so excited that you made a mistake, that you messed up. I'm so excited that now I feel better about myself because you're such a screw up. That's not love. The wisest man ever to live was a guy by the name of Solomon, and he wrote a book called Proverbs, and it's in our Old Testament of the Bible. And in Proverbs, Solomon writes this: do not gloat when your enemy falls, when they stumble. Do not let your heart rejoice, or the Lord will see and disprove and turn his wrath away from them. Did you get what Solomon just said? He said, even with your enemy, with someone who is your sworn enemy, who you would say, that's the bad guy, that's my tormentor, that's someone I don't like, that even when they torment you, that you are not to say, yes, they got what was coming to them. That if you gloat, if you rejoice, when even your enemy gets down, gets hurt, that God is like, I so disapprove of that. And if it's that case with our enemies, how much more should it be with those that are in our life? Those that we love, that our family, our church family, our friends, our co-workers. There should be no schadenfreude inside any of us, that we shouldn't rejoice when others fall, when they stumble, that we shouldn't feel better about ourselves, that actually our heart should break. I love this idea from one commentary. It says, it is common for people to rejoice when an enemy is found guilty of a crime or caught in a sin. This is not love. Love rejoices in the virtue of others, not in their vices. Sin is an occasion for sorrow and not for joy. What is the Christian response when someone messes up? The Christian response is not anger, and it's not, I told you so, and God's going to get you. The Christian response, when you see someone in your life sin, the Christian response is that your heart breaks and you're sorrowful. Because not only are they messing up their life, they are missing God's best for them. And so when we see someone sin, especially those that are outside of the church, can we just talk about this just for a second? Guys, if you're here today and you're a Christian, you've got to be honest with yourself and say that you still struggle. You're doing your best to follow God, but there's still times when you miss the mark. But if there are those who do not believe in God, who are not a part of the church, we should not hold them to our same standards. And we should not expect them to be trying as hard to live the moral life that we're living. And so when we see someone outside of the church and they miss the mark, we shouldn't be saying, yep, okay, they're such a bad person, they're so evil, we should not be gloating over them. We should literally be hitting our knees and saying, oh my God, they're missing it. They're missing your best for their life. And even sometimes sin makes us feel uncomfortable, certain life choices, certain things that people do, and it makes us feel really uneasy. And we say, okay, that doesn't go against the Bible. And the common response for Christians is to come out in judgment and to come out in anger and say, because that's wrong, let me tell you how you should live your life. But the Christian response is not of judgment or of anger. It is of heartbreak. That when someone does not follow the standards of God, they are missing the mark. They are missing God's best for them, and we should fall down on our knees and say, dear God, please have mercy on them. Would you draw them to you? They are missing out on what you've called them to do. So when your friends, when your families, when your coworkers are dealing with sin, when they're dealing with issues, the common response is to start spreading this and start saying, hey, did you hear what? Let me tell you what I heard. Let me tell you what I found out about them. Well, that's schadenfreude, that we want to share the misfortunes of others because somehow it makes us feel better about ourselves. The Christian response, though, when people sin is that you should literally get down on your knees and cry out to God. And your heart should break for those who sin differently than you do. One commentary said that it takes no pleasure to see an adversary fall into an error of sin by which his reputation should be blasted and his interest ruined. On the contrary, the man influenced by his love is truly sorry for either the sin or folly or even an enemy. Takes no pleasure in hearing or in repeating it, but desires it may be forgiven forever. When Paul says that love does not delight in evil, it is painting a picture that you don't even dare tell someone else about what has just happened with your friend, with your coworker, with your enemy who has sinned. You don't want to even spread that. You don't even want to rejoice. You don't want to be anything around that, that you want to spend your time with a broken heart and saying, dear God, please call them back to you. God, they have royally screwed up. When we go and we tell other people and we spread the news of how others have fallen and we say, hey, did you hear what they did? Did you see what's happened there? When we spread this gossip, it is schadenfreude. It is an insecurity. It is making ourselves feel better about who we are. Because as long as we can talk about other people, we don't have to focus on our own issues. But Paul doesn't stop there. Let's read the verse one more time. Paul says, love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. So he paints this picture. There's this contrast that if you're here today and you're a Christian, that true love does not delight in evil. It's not schadenfreude. It's not rejoicing when other people mess up. But he tells us what we should do. Instead of rejoicing in evil, we should rejoice with the truth. Or instead of delighting in evil, we should rejoice with the truth. Now, this needs some explaining as well, because we live in a culture where people love to tell us the truth online, anonymously, behind our backs. Our culture loves this. What we don't love to do is we don't love to have hard conversations where we speak the truth in love to the people we care about. But we love to, behind a keyboard, tell someone how they should live or how someone should feel. And we love to tell someone when we disagree with their opinion. And this happens all the time, especially with social media. Paul says, though, that love does not delight in evil, but it rejoices with the truth. And this has a double meaning as well, that rejoicing with the truth is not just that you say, I know the truth, so let me rejoice it all over you and tell you how bad you are and tell you what you should do. That's not the picture that Paul is painting. What Paul is saying is that you rejoice with the truth. That is, when someone has a victory, when someone has a win, you celebrate. They overcame that addiction. Woo! They survived that. Yes, their marriage got back together. I'm rejoicing with the truth. But there's a second understanding here with rejoicing with the truth. It's not just rejoicing with other people. It's also rejoicing when the truth is brought to you. This is difficult because, again, in our society, most of the time, the only time we hear anyone telling us the truth, it's from some anonymous source, some people that we don't even know behind a keyboard who's trying to tell us how we should live. And this is difficult because, like, how do you know when someone comes to you with a hard truth, how do you know if they're coming to you in love or if they're just being a critic? I recently read a book by Pastor Perry Noble, and he did a great job of painting this picture of the difference between a coach and a critic. And a coach is someone in your life who tells you what you should do, what you need to do, gives you the hard truth, but does it in a loving way that you'll accept it. A critic is someone that doesn't have your best interests in mind. And he breaks it down in this way. Coaches, you'll see it on the right, coaches have a relationship with you. So here's one thing that you need to understand right away. If someone comes to you and they don't have a relationship with you and they're wanting to rejoice with the truth, they are a critic and they're not a coach and you don't listen to them. You don't know me. You don't know my circumstance. You don't know anything about me. You're not even trying to get to know me. You're just trying to tell me how to live my life. You're a critic. So coach versus a critic. A critic hardly knows you at all. A coach assumes the best. A critic assumes the worst. A coach is someone in your life who says, okay, you missed practice. I'm believing it's for a good reason and not just because you're a lazy bum and you slept in. A coach is someone who believes the best about you. You may have fallen 3 or 4 times, but I believe in you. I believe you're going to get this. I believe that you're going to get to that next level. I believe the best about you. A critic is someone who assumes the worst. Here they go again. Let me tell you why they were late. They were late because they are so lazy. That is not someone who rejoices with the truth. A coach is someone who corrects out of love. A critic corrects out of pride. A coach is someone that says, hey, the reason I want to tell you this is not because I think I'm better than you. I want to tell you this because I care so deeply about you. I want your life to become better. A critic is someone who says, let me tell you how you should live your life. I don't agree with what you just said. I don't agree with your stance. Let me tell you all about how wrong you are. That is a critic versus a coach. A coach is someone who has earned our respect. A critic has not earned our respect. A coach is someone who handles things privately. A critic is someone who goes publicly. If you ever see a public rant against someone else, it is a critic. It is someone who is full of pride. It is someone who is not willing to have the hard conversations face to face. Because guess what? It is so much easier to blast someone behind the safety of a keyboard than it is to talk to them in love face to face. A coach versus a critic. A coach will love you through a disagreement. A critic will hate you no matter what. What's the difference between a coach in your life and a critic? Well, a coach is going to tell you what they think you should do out of love. And if you disagree, they're going to say, that doesn't change my opinion of you. I still love you. I want what's best for you. I wish you would listen to me, but I still love you. A critic, on the other hand, is going to hate you no matter what. A coach should be listened to, and a critic should be ignored. Now, we should, because love rejoices in the truth, we should be looking for coaches. If you don't have someone in your life who can speak the truth to you in love, it is because you're afraid of the hard truths. It's because you've got some Schlitterbahn in you. You've got some I totally butchered that word. Schlitterbahn is a water park in San Antonio. Another German word. It is a German word, Schlitterbahn. You should go. It's an amazing park. Schadenfreude is the German word I was looking for. But you have something inside of you that the reason that you don't want a coach in your life is because you would rather not deal with the difficult things in your life. You would rather just feel better about yourself. So you're going to hang out with people that make you feel good, but not rejoice with the truth. Rejoicing with the truth is finding people in your life who can say, hey, you know what? This is really difficult. This isn't easy. But I love you so much. I want what's best for you. If someone cannot tell you the truth to your face, they do not love you. If someone cannot tell you the truth to your face, they do not love you. So let me tell you how this works. If there's someone in your life that has a real genuine concern about you, maybe your marriage or your kids, or maybe it's your spiritual life, and they can talk to everyone else about you, but they can't talk to you, they do not love you. Love rejoices with the truth. Love says, hey, I care about you so much that I'm seeing that there's some harm in you, and I want to expose this. Even if you disagree, I'm still with you. Love rejoices in the truth. Last week, a friend of ours was hanging out at the house, and I was in the TV showroom watching Netflix, minding my own business, and she was hanging with my wife in the dining room, and they were talking, and I wasn't really paying attention, and somehow the conversation turned to me, and I heard my name and zoned in, and this friend is a coach, is a good friend, is someone who is a part of CrossFit that I'm a part of, and this friend turns to me and says, Rob, how much do you weigh? Now, there are a couple unwritten rules when it comes to weight. You do not ask a woman how much she weighs, and you do not ask a preacher how much he weighs. Those are unwritten rules. Some of you are new to the church and you don't know that. You don't ask a preacher how much he weighs. And so I kind of paused for a little bit, and I was like, okay, well, she's a friend, so you know, I know she's not going to judge me. So I told her my weight, and then she said, well, how much did you weigh when you were losing all that weight? Like, what was your best weight? And I told her that, and she said, okay, we're going to get you back to that. And I said, okay. And she said, here's a challenge for you. I want you to start drinking a gallon of water. I want you to make it to CrossFit 4 times a week. And I want you to start logging your calories. And I'm going to do this with you. I'm going to challenge you to lose 10 pounds in a month. Now, was that easy to hear? No, because I was watching Netflix. That was easy. Like, but what does a good coach do? A good coach sees something in your life and says, you know what? You've gone off track. You've missed the mark. And I'm not telling you this because I'm better than you. I'm telling you this because I care about you, and I want to help you become better. I take no enjoyment in seeing you miss the mark. That is a coach. And a coach can look at you in the eyes and tell you the truth in love. We need some coaches in our life. We need to invite coaches into our life. But we also need to flip this around. Because if you can't tell someone how you feel, you love yourself more than you love them. If you can't tell someone how you feel, you love yourself more than you love them. If you have these conversations where you say things like, I don't think they should get married, but you don't tell them, you tell all of your friends. You don't love them, you love yourself. If you have conversations like, yeah, can you believe the choices that he is making? But you don't say it to him, you say it to your friends. You love yourself more than you love them. True love rejoices with the truth. And true love's heart, it breaks when someone else is in sin. And love is not selfish. Love puts itself in someone else's shoes. Love looks at someone else and says, I care so much about you. I'm a coach for you. I'm in your corner. I want what's best for you. Let's have a hard conversation. But you need to know, if you disagree, I'm still in your corner. If you can't tell someone how you feel, you love yourself more than you love them. In ancient Greece, Socrates had a great reputation for wisdom. And one day someone came to find Socrates, and they said to him, you know what I just heard about your friend? And they were wanting to spread some gossip, and they were wanting to tell them how bad a mistake that their friend made. And Socrates replied, well, wait just a minute. Before you tell me about it, I'd like to run a test. The test of the three sieves. The friend said, the three sieves? Yes, continued Socrates. Before you tell anything about the other person, let's take a time to filter out what this means. I call it the test of the three thieves. The first sieve is the truth. Did you check if what you're going to tell me is true? So before you tell me this juicy bit of gossip, before you tell me about how bad my friend is, did you even check with your source? Did you check to make sure this was true? And the guy replied, no, I didn't check with that. It's just what I heard. Socrates said, well, very well. So you don't even know if it's true. He continued to the second sieve, and the second sieve is a sieve of goodness. He says, what do you want to tell me about my friend? Is it a good thing? And the man replied, said, oh, no, it's on the contrary. It's a pretty bad thing about your friend. So question Socrates, you want to tell me bad things about him and you're not even sure they are true. Well, maybe you can still pass the third test. The third sieve is the sieve of unity. Is it useful, as far as I know, what you're going to tell me about this friend? And the man said, no, like seriously, it's not useful at all. So Socrates concluded, well, what you are going to tell me is neither true nor good nor useful. So why did you want to tell me that? So often we want people to tell us bad news about others because it causes us to feel better about ourselves. But that's not love. Love rejoices with the truth. Love has a heart that breaks. If someone comes to you with bad news, you drop down on your knees and you say, dear God, no, I don't want them to fail. I don't want them to fall. I don't want to hear this. I don't want to spread this. I don't want to be a part of this. They have missed the mark, and they've missed the enjoyment and the excitement of receiving you in that moment, God. Would you please have mercy on them? They have fallen. Your heart should break when people sin. You don't rejoice with it. And yet when you're with someone, when you're in a relationship, love says that you do rejoice with the truth. That is that you encourage them. You say, hey, listen, I believe in you so much, I'm going to tell you the truth. You can do better. You can do better in your relationships. You can do better in life. That is a coach. That is someone we want to welcome into our lives. So here's the application. How do you apply this idea of love, this definition of love? This is the application. It's simply this. Ask God to break your heart for what breaks His. Ask God to break your heart for what breaks His. If you have a response that is anything else than a broken heart to sin, you do not have the eyes of God. Because we need to remember, this definition of love is truly a definition of God. And when God looks at us, this is how God loves us. And so we need to have that same mindset with others. So literally cry out to God, pray to Him and say, God, would you break my heart for what breaks yours? Would you help me to care about people when they're hurting and sinning and not feel better about myself? Would you help me to have a mindset and love others the same way that you love me? Would you guys pray with me? God, thank you for this day and thank you for your love for us. God, we just ask right now in Jesus' name that you would just speak clear truth to us. That you would speak in ways, God, that you would speak in ways where we would hear you. We ask, God, that you would just do immeasurably more than we could ask or imagine. That you would break our hearts for what breaks yours. God, that we would be a people who don't rejoice when other people fall, but that we drop on our knees and we cry out to you. God, would you help us to welcome in coaches? Would you help us to be a church that is looking to find people to make us better? Would you help us to rejoice with the truth? We thank you, Lord, for what you're going to do, for how you're going to do it. We ask you to stir our hearts to fall more in love with you. In Jesus' name, amen.
We hope you've enjoyed and learned from today's podcast. If you'd like to connect with us further, you can check out our website, nextlevelchurch.net, or find us on Facebook or Twitter.